this week on Books Unbound.
And while I was trying to think of what sort of a life I could lead so that I could have a little peace and quiet and save up something for my old age, God lit up my path and put me on the road to success. I got what I wanted, a government job.
The conclusion of the life of Lazarillo de Tormes, his fortunes and misfortunes as told by himself, a Spanish novella published anonymously during the Inquisition. Books Unbound is a production of Community Radio WFHB. Books Unbound is a production of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana. For WFHB, I'm Berkeley Going.
And I'm Sarah Torbeck. The life of Lazarillo de Tormes was one of the few novels banned by the Spanish Inquisition. The identity of the author is unknown. He is sometimes thought to be a converso, a convert to Catholicism from either a Jewish or Muslim family. Lázaro has an outsider's perspective on Christianity. To him, this religion seems like a way to make a living. He was a new kind of protagonist, the pícaro, a powerless rascal who belongs nowhere, scrambling just to get by. He's clever, but unschooled, and learns his lessons in life the hard way. The picaresque novel as a genre responds to the social conditions of its time. European culture had begun to be dominated by the capitalist values arising from the expansion of trade and commerce in the 16th century. At the same time, the first half of the century had brought widespread crop failures and economic dislocations. As cities grew, so too did the numbers of poor and marginalized people. Lazarillo was published at a time when church and secular authorities were redefining their responsibilities for the poor. Despite criticisms of priestly excess and hypocrisy, the Catholic Church traditionally had ministered to the poor without discrimination. The church hierarchy had inherited the social system of the Roman Empire, in which providing welfare for the lower classes was essential for aristocrats to maintain their power and privilege. Christianity had imbued this power structure with the moral principle that universal charity was God's work, something that could be given but not earned. Protestantism, however, developed along with capitalism and its ethic of self-reliance. The value of charity was determined by its outcomes. The deserving poor were those who attempted to provide labor or were physically unable to do so. Those who were unproductive were undeserving of charity. Lazarillo's ability to pull himself up by his bootstraps, before he even has boots, makes a mockery of this ethic. The less moral he becomes, the more he succeeds. Reformists in Catholic countries such as Spain debated the issue in terms familiar from our own political divisions, whether the poor are victims of their vices and failings, or are mostly ordinary people trapped by circumstances. Throughout Europe, cities attempted to regulate poverty by law, requiring beggars to have a license, barring poor immigrants from entering, and treating vagabonds as criminals. In the story, Lázaro arrives in the Spanish city of Toledo, just as these poor laws have been enacted.
As we rejoin our hero, or rather anti-hero, he's passed into the service of a third master. His first was a shrewd blind man, and the second, a miserly priest. They both starved him, but he learned a few tricks of survival. Lázaro feels lucky to get a position with a kindlier gentleman, but soon finds that his new master is poorer than the first two, though he stubbornly tries to maintain appearances and his sense of honor.
I can't say for sure what happened during the next 3 days because I spent them inside the belly of the whale, but what I've just told I heard about from my master when I came to. He was telling what had happened in detail to everyone who came by. At the end of 3 days, when I was back in my senses, I found myself stretched out on my straw bed with my head all bandaged up and full of oils and salves. And I got scared and said, "What is this?" The cruel priest answered, "It seems that I caught the mice and snakes that were ruining me." I looked myself over, and when I saw how badly beaten up I was, I guessed what had happened. Then an old lady who was a healer came in, along with the neighbors, and they began to take the wrappings off my head and treat the wound. When they saw that I was conscious again, they were very happy, and they said, "Well, he's got his senses back. God willing, it won't be too serious." Then they began to talk again about what had happened to me and to laugh, while I, sinner that I was crying. Anyway, they fed me, and I was famished, but they really didn't give me enough. Yet, little by little, I recovered, and 2 weeks later, I was able to get up out of any danger, but not out of my state of hunger, and nearly cured. The next day, when I'd gotten up, my master took me by the hand and led me out the door. And when I was in the street, he said to me, "Lazaro, from now on, you're on your own. I don't want you. Go get yourself another master, and God be with you. I don't want such a diligent servant here with me. You could only have become this way from being a blind man's guide." Then he crossed himself as if I had the devil in me and went back into his house and closed the door. Chapter 3. How Lazaro took up with a squire and what happened to him then. So I had to push on ahead, as weak as I was, and little by little, with the help of some good people, I ended up in the great city of Toledo. And here, by the grace of God, my wounds healed in about 2 weeks. People were always giving me things while I was hurt, but when I was well again, they told me, "You're nothing but a lazy, no-good sponger. Go on, go find yourself a good master you can work for." "And where will I meet up with one of those," I said to myself, "unless God makes him from scratch, the way he created the world?" While I was going along begging from door to door, without much success, since charity seemed to have gone up to heaven, God had me run into a squire who was walking down the street. He was well-dressed, his hair was combed, and he walked and looked like a real gentleman. I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he said, "Boy, are you looking for a master?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "Well, come with me," he said. "God has been good to you, making you run into me. You must have been doing some good praying today." So I went with him. And I thank God that he asked me to go along because, with his nice-looking clothes and the way he looked, I thought he was just what I needed. It was morning when I found my third master, and I followed him through most of the city. We went through squares where they were selling bread and different things, and I was hoping and praying that he would load me up with some food they were selling because it was just the right time for shopping. But very quickly, without stopping, we went right past those places. "Maybe he doesn't like what he sees here," I thought, "and he wants to buy his groceries somewhere else." So we kept on walking until it was 11 o'clock. Then he went into the cathedral, and I was right behind him. I saw him listen to Mass and go through the other holy ceremonies very devoutly until it was over and the people had gone. Then we came out of the church. We began to go down the street at a good clip, and I was the happiest fellow in the world, since we hadn't stopped to buy any food. I really thought my new master was one of those people who do all their shopping at once, and that our meal would be there, ready and waiting for us, just the way I wanted. And, in fact, the way I needed. At that minute, the clock struck one, an hour past noon, and we came to a house where my master stopped, and so did I. And pulling his cape to the left, he took a key out of his sleeve and opened the door, and we both went into the house. The entrance was dark and gloomy. It looked like it would make anyone who went in afraid. But inside there was a little patio and some fairly nice rooms. Once we were in, he took off his cape. He asked me if my hands were clean, and then we shook it out and folded it. And blowing the dust very carefully off a stone bench that was there, he put the cape down on top of it. And when that was done, he sat down next to it and asked me a lot of questions about where I was from and how I'd happened to come to that city. I talked about myself longer than I wanted to because I thought it was more a time to have the table set and the stew dished up than to tell him about all that. Still, I satisfied him about myself, lying as well as I could. I told him all my good points, but kept quiet about the rest, since I didn't think that was the time for them. When that was over, he just sat there for a while. I began to realize that that was a bad sign, since it was almost 2 o'clock, and I hadn't seen him show any more desire to eat than a dead man. Then I began to think about his keeping the door locked, and the fact that I hadn't heard any other sign of life in the whole house. The only thing I'd seen were walls. Not a chair, not a meat-cutting board, a stool, a table, or even a chest like the one I'd had before. And I began to wonder if that house was under a spell. While I was thinking about this, he said to me, "Boy, have you eaten?" "No, sir," I said. "It wasn't even 8 o'clock when I met you."
"Well, even though it was still morning, I'd already had breakfast. And when I eat like that, I want you to know that I'm satisfied until nighttime. So you'll just have to get along as well as you can. We'll have supper later."
You can see how, when I heard this, I nearly dropped in my tracks, not so much from hunger, but because fate seemed to be going completely against me. Then all my troubles passed before my eyes, and I began to cry over my hardships once more. I remembered my reasoning when I was thinking about leaving the priest. I figured that even though he was mean and stingy, it might turn out that I would meet up with someone worse. So there I was, moping over the hard life I'd had and over my death that was getting nearer and nearer. And yet, Keeping track of my emotions as well as I could, I said to him, "Sir, I am only a boy, and thank God I'm not too concerned about eating. I can tell you that I was the lightest eater of all my friends, and all the masters I've ever had have praised that about me right up to now." "That really is a virtue," he said, "and it makes me appreciate you even more, because only pigs stuff themselves. Gentlemen eat moderately." I get the picture, I thought to myself. Well, damn all the health and virtue that these masters I run into find in staying hungry. I went over next to the door and took out of my shirt some pieces of bread that I still had from begging. When he saw this, he said to me, "Come here, boy. What are you eating?" I went over to him and showed him the bread. There were 3 pieces, and he took one, the biggest and best one. Then he said, "Well, well, this does look like good bread." "It is," I said. "But tell me, sir, do you really think so now?" "Yes, I do," he said. "Where did you get it? I wonder if the baker had clean hands." "I can't tell you that," I said, "but it certainly doesn't taste bad." "Let's see if you're right," said my poor master. And he put it in his mouth and began to gobble it down as ferociously as I was doing with mine. "Bless me, this bread is absolutely delicious," he said. When I saw what tree he was barking up, I began to eat faster, because I realized that if he finished before I did, he would be nice enough to help me with what was left. So we finished almost at the same time, and he began to brush off a few crumbs, very tiny ones, that were left on his shirt. Then he went into a little room nearby and brought out a chipped-up jug, not a very new one, and after he had drunk, he offered it to me. But, so I would look like a teetotaler, I said, "Sir, I don't drink wine."
"It's water," he said. "You can drink that."
Then I took the jug and I drank, but not much, because being thirsty wasn't exactly my trouble. So that's how we spent the day until nighttime, him asking me questions and me answering as best I could. Then he took me to the room where the jug that we drank from was, and he said to me, "Boy, get over there, and I'll show you how this bed is made up so that you'll be able to do it from now on." I went down to one end, and he went over to the other, and we made up the blasted bed. There really wasn't much to do. It just had a bamboo frame sitting on some benches, and on top of that there was a filthy mattress with the bedclothes stretched over it. And since it hadn't been washed very often, it really didn't look much like a mattress. But that's what it was used for, though there was a lot less stuffing than it needed. We stretched it out and tried to soften it up, but that was impossible because you can't really make a hard object soft. And that blessed pack saddle had hardly a damn thing inside it. When it was put on the frame, every strut showed through, and it looked just like the ribcage of a real skinny pig. And on top of that starving pad, he put a cover of the same stamp. I never could decide what color it was. With the bed made and night on us, he said to me, "Lazaro, it's late now, and it's a long way from here to the square. And besides, there are a lot of thieves who go around stealing at night in this city. Let's get along as well as we can, and tomorrow, when it's daytime, God will be good to us. I've been living alone, and so I haven't stocked up any groceries. Instead, I've been eating out. But from now on, we'll do things differently."
"Sir," I said, "don't worry about me. I can spend one night, or more if I have to, without eating."
"You'll live longer, and you'll be healthier, too," he answered. "Because, as we were saying today, there's nothing in the world like eating moderately to live a long life."
If that's the way things are, I thought to myself, I will never die. Because I've always been forced to keep that rule, and with my luck, I'll probably keep it all my life. And he lay down on the bed, using his pants and jacket as a pillow. He told me to stretch out at his feet, so I did. But I didn't get a damn bit of sleep. The frame struts and my protruding bones didn't stop squabbling and fighting all night long. With all the pains, hunger, and trouble I'd been through, I don't think there was a pound of flesh left on my body. And since I'd hardly had a bite to eat that day, I was groveling in hunger. And hunger and sleep don't exactly make good bedfellows. So I cursed myself, God forgive me, and my bad luck over and over, nearly all night long. And what was worse, I didn't dare to turn over because I might wake him up, so I just kept asking God for death. When morning came, we got up and he began to shake out and clean his pants and jacket and his coat and cape while I stood around like an idle servant. And he took his own good time about getting dressed. I brought some water for him to wash his hands, and then he combed his hair and put his sword in the belt. And while he was doing that, he said,
"If you only knew what a prize this was, boy, I wouldn't sell it for any amount of money in the world.
And I'll have you know that of all the swords the famous Toledan swordmaker Antonio made, there isn't one that he put as sharp an edge on as this one has.
And he pulled it out of the sheath and felt it with his fingers and said,
Look here, I'll bet I could slice a ball of wool with it.
And I thought to myself, with my teeth, even though they are not made of steel, I could slice a 4-pound loaf of bread. He put it back in the sheath and strapped it on, and then he hung a string of large beads from the sword belt. And he walked slowly, holding his body straight and swaying gracefully as he walked. And every so often, he would put the tail of the cape over his shoulder or under his arm. And with his right hand on his side, he went out the door, saying,
Lazaro, while I go to Mass, you watch the house.
Then he went up the street with such a stately expression and manner that anyone who didn't know him would think he was a close relative to the Count of Arcos, or at least his valet. I stood there thinking, Bless you, Lord, you give us sickness and you cure us too. My master looked so content that anyone who saw him would think he'd eaten a huge supper last night and slept in a nice bed. And even though it's early in the morning, they'd think he'd had a good breakfast. Your ways are mighty mysterious, Lord, and people don't understand them. With that refined way he acts and that nice-looking cape and coat, he'd fool anyone. And who would believe that that gracious man got by all day yesterday on a piece of bread that his servant Lazaro had carried all day and night inside his shirt for safekeeping? Not really the most sanitary place in the world. And that today, when he washed his hands and face, he dried them on his shirt tail because we didn't have any towels. Nobody would suspect it, of course. Oh, Lord, how many of these people do you have scattered around the world who suffer for the filth that they call honor, what they would never suffer for you? So I stood at the door thinking about these things and looking until my master had disappeared down the long, narrow street. Then I went back into the house, and in a second I walked through the whole place, both upstairs and down, without stopping or finding anything to stop for. I made up that blasted hard bed and took the jug down to the river, and I saw my master in a garden trying hard to coax two veiled women. They look like the kind that are always hanging around that place. In fact, a lot of them go there in the summer to take the early morning air. And they go down to those cool riverbanks to eat breakfast, without even bringing any food along. They're sure someone will give them some, since the men around there have got them in the habit of doing that. As I say, there he was with them, just like the troubadour Masius, telling them more sweet words than Ovid ever wrote. And when they saw that he was pretty well softened up, they weren't ashamed to ask him for some breakfast, promising the usual payment. But his pocketbook was as cold as his stomach was warm, and he began to have such hot chills that the color drained from his face, and he started to trip over his tongue and make up some lame excuses. They must have been pretty experienced women, because they caught on to his illness right away and left him there for what he was. I'd been eating some cabbage stalks, and that was my breakfast, and since I was a new servant, I went back home very diligently without my master seeing me. I decided I'd sweep out a little there, since that's what the place really needed, but I couldn't find anything to sweep with. Then I began to think about what I should do, and I decided to wait until noon for my master, because if he came, he might bring something to eat. But that turned out to be a waste of time. When I saw that it was getting to be 2 o'clock and he still hadn't come, I began to be attacked by hunger. So I locked the door and put the key where he told me to, and then I went back to my old trade. With a low, sickly voice, my hands crossed over my chest, and with my eyes looking up to heaven and God's name on my tongue, I began to beg for bread at the doors of the biggest houses I saw. But I'd been doing this almost from the cradle. I mean, I learned it from that great teacher, the blind man, and I turned out to be a pretty good student. So even though this town had never been very charitable, and it had been a pretty lean year besides, I handled myself so well that before the clock struck 4, I had that many pounds of bread stored away in my stomach and at least 2 more in my sleeves and inside my shirt. I went back to the house, and on my way through the meat market, I begged from one of the women there, and she gave me a piece of cow's hoof along with some cooked tripe.
You've been listening to the satiric novella Lazarillo de Tormes on Books Unbound, a production of WFHB. We'll be back after the break. Thank you. We now return to Lazarillo de Tormes and Books Unbound on WFHB.
In 1996, a copy of a previously unknown edition of Lazarillo de Tormes was found in a small town in western Spain. The book had lain hidden inside a wall for 4.5 centuries. Other prohibited books were found with it, including a satire of a Platonic dialogue reveling in explicit sex among men. The cache was protected by a paper amulet. The use of magic objects was considered a superstitious offense under the Inquisition. Its presence with banned books suggests that the owner was himself an outsider who might have identified with Lázaro.
When I got home, my good master was there, his cape folded and lying on the stone bench, and he was walking around in the patio. I went inside, and he came over to me. I thought he was going to scold me for being late, but God had something better in store. He asked me where I'd been, and I told him, "Sir, I was here until 2 o'clock, and when I saw that you weren't coming, I went to the city and put myself in the hands of the good people there, and they gave me what you see here." I showed him the bread and the tripe that I was carrying in my shirt tail, and his face lit up and he said,
"Well, I held up dinner for you, but when I saw that you weren't going to come, I went ahead and ate. But what you've done there is all right, because it's better to beg in God's name than to steal. That's my opinion, so help me. The only thing I ask is that you don't tell anyone that you're living with me, because it will hurt my honor. But I think you would stay a secret anyway, since hardly anyone in this town knows me. I wish I'd never come here."
"Don't worry about that, sir," I said. "No one would give a damn about asking me that, and I wouldn't tell them even if they did."
"Well then, eat, you poor sinner. If it's God's will, we'll soon see ourselves out of these straits. But I want you to know that ever since I came to this house, nothing has gone right for me. There must be an evil spell on it. You know, there are some unlucky houses that are cursed, and the bad luck rubs off on the people who live in them. I don't doubt for a minute that this is one of them, but I tell you that after this month is over, I wouldn't live here even if they gave the place to me."
I sat down at the end of the stone bench, and I kept quiet about my snack so that he wouldn't take me for a glutton. So, for supper, I began to eat my tripe and bread while I was watching my poor master out of the corner of my eye. And he kept staring at my shirt tail that I was using for a plate. I hope God takes as much pity on me as I felt for him. I knew just what he was feeling, since the same thing had happened to me lots of times. And, in fact, it was still happening to me. I thought about asking him to join me, but since he told me that he'd already eaten, I was afraid he wouldn't accept the invitation. The fact is, I was hoping that the sinner would help himself to the food I had gone to the trouble of getting, and that he'd eat the way he did the day before so he could get out of his own troubles. This was really a better time for it, since there was more food and I wasn't as hungry. God decided to grant my wish, and his too, I guess, because he was still walking around, but when I began to eat, he came over to me and said,
"I tell you, Lázaro, I've never seen anyone eat with as much gusto as you put into it. Anyone watching you would get hungry on the spot, even if he hadn't been before."
"The marvelous appetite you have," I thought to myself, "makes you think mine is beautiful." Still, I decided to help him, since he had opened up a way for me himself. So I said to him, "Sir, a man can do a good job if he has good tools. This bread is absolutely delicious, and the cow's hoof is so well cooked and seasoned that no one could possibly resist its taste."
"Is it cow's hoof?"
"Yes, sir."
"I tell you, there's no better dish in the world. I don't even like pheasant as much."
"Well, dig in, sir, and you'll see how good it really is." I put the cow's hooves into his hands, along with 3 or 4 of the whiter pieces of bread, and he sat down beside me and began to eat like a man who was really hungry. He chewed the meat off of every little bone better than any hound of his would have done.
"With garlic sauce," he said, "this is an exceptional dish."
"You don't need any sauce with your appetite," I said under my breath.
"By God, that tasted so good, you'd think I hadn't had a bite to eat all day."
"That's true, as sure as I was born," I said to myself. He asked me for the water jug, and we drank and went to sleep, very content, like we'd done the night before. Well, to make a long story short, that's the way we spent the next 9 or 10 days. That sinner would go out in the morning with his satisfied, leisurely pace to dawdle around the streets while I was out hoofing it for him. I used to think lots of times about my catastrophe, having escaped from those terrible masters I'd had and looking for someone better, I ran into a man who not only couldn't support me, but who I had to support. Still, I really liked him because I saw that he didn't have anything and he couldn't do more than he was already doing. I felt more sorry for him than angry. And lots of times, just so I could bring back something for him to eat, I didn't eat anything myself. I did this because one morning the pitiful fellow got up in his shirt and went to the top floor of the house to take care of a certain necessity, and to satisfy my curiosity, I unfolded the jacket and pants he'd left at the head of the bed, and I found an old, crumpled-up little purse of satiny velvet that didn't have a damn cent in it, and there wasn't any sign that it had had one for a long time. "This man," I said, "is poor, and no one can give what he doesn't have, but both the stingy blind man and that blasted miser of a priest did all right in God's name, one of them with a quick tongue and the other with his hand kissing, and they were starving me to death. So it's only right that I should hate them and feel sorry for this man. As God is my witness, even today when I run into someone like him, with that pompous way of walking of his, I feel sorry for them because I think that they may be suffering what I saw this one go through. But even with all his poverty, I'd still be glad to serve him more than the others because of the things I've just mentioned. There was only one little thing that I didn't like about him. I wish that he wouldn't act so superior. If only he'd let his vanity come down a little to be in line with his growing necessity. But it seems to me that that's a rule that his kind always keeps. Even if they don't have a red cent to their name, they have to keep up the masquerade. God help them, or that's the way they'll go to their graves." Well, while I was there, getting along the way I said, my bad luck, which never got tired of haunting me, decided that that hard, foul way of life shouldn't last. The way it happened was that, since there had been a crop failure there that year, the town council decided to make all the beggars who came from other towns get out of the city, and they announced that from then on, if they found one of them there, he'd be whipped. So the law went into effect, and 4 days after the announcement was given, I saw a procession of beggars being led through the streets and whipped. And I got so scared that I didn't dare go out begging anymore. It's not hard to imagine the dieting that went on in my house and the sadness and silence of the people living there. It was so bad that for 2 or 3 days at a time, we wouldn't have a bite to eat or even say one word to each other. I knew some ladies who lived next door to us. They spun cotton and made hats, and they kept me alive. From what little they brought in, they always gave me something, and I just about managed to get by. But I didn't feel as sorry for myself as I did for my poor master. He didn't have a damn bite to eat in a week. At least, we didn't have anything to eat in the house. When he went out, I don't know how he got along, where he went, or what he ate. And if you could only have seen him coming down the street at noon, holding himself straight and skinnier than a full-blooded greyhound. And because of his damn, what do you call it, honor, he would take a toothpick, and there weren't very many of those in the house either, and go out the door picking at what didn't have anything between them and still grumbling about the cursed place. He'd say, "Look how bad things are, and it's this blasted house that's causing it all. Look how gloomy and dark and dismal it is. As long as we stay here, we're going to suffer. I wish the month were over so we could get out of here." Well, while we were in this terrible, hungry state, one day, I don't know by what stroke of luck or good fortune, a silver piece found its way into the poor hands of my master, and he brought it home with him, looking as proud as if he had all the money in Venice, and smiling very happily, he gave it to me and said, "Take this, Lazaro. God is beginning to be good to us. Go down to the square and buy bread and wine and meat. Let's shoot the works. And also, this should make you happy, I want you to know that I've rented another house, so we'll only stay in this unlucky place until the end of the month. Damn the place and damn the person who put the first tile on its roof. I should never have rented it. I swear to God that as long as I've lived here, I haven't had a drop of wine or a bite of meat, and I haven't gotten any rest. And it's all because of the way this place looks, so dark and gloomy. Go on now, and come back as quick as you can. We'll eat like kings today." I took my silver coin and my jug, and hurrying along, I went up the street, heading for the square, very content and happy. But what's the use if my bad luck has it planned for me that I can't enjoy anything without trouble coming along with it? And that's the way this thing went.
I was going up the street thinking about how I would spend the money in the best way possible and get the most out of it, and I was thanking God with all my heart for letting my master have some money, when suddenly I came upon a corpse that a bunch of clergy and other people were carrying down the street on a litter. I squeezed up next to the wall to let them by, and after the body had gone past, there came right behind the litter a woman who must have been the dead man's wife, all dressed up in mourning, and a lot of other women with her. And she came along crying loudly and saying, "My husband and Lord, where are they taking you? It's to that poor unhappy house, that dark and gloomy house, that house where they never eat or drink." And when I heard that, I felt like I had fallen through the ground, and I said, "Oh no, they're taking this dead man to my house." I turned around and squeezed through the crowd and ran back down the street as fast as I could toward my house. And when I got inside, I closed the door right behind me and called out for my master to come and help me. And I grabbed hold of him and begged him to help me block the door. He was a little stunned, thinking it might be something else, and he asked me, "What is it, boy? Why are you shouting? What's the matter? Why did you slam the door so hard?" "Oh, sir," I said, "help me. They're bringing a dead man here."
"What do you mean?" he asked.
"I stumbled into him just up the way from here, and his wife was coming along saying, 'My husband and Lord, where are they taking you? To the dark and gloomy house, the poor unhappy house, the house where they never eat or drink. Oh, sir, they're bringing him here.'" And I tell you that when my master heard that, even though he didn't have any reason for being very cheerful, he laughed so hard that for a long time he couldn't even talk. In the meantime, I had the bolt snapped shut on the door and my shoulder against it to hold them all back. The people passed by with the corpse, and I was still afraid that they were going to stick him in our house. And when he'd had his belly full of laughter, more than of food, my good master said to me,
"It's true, Lazaro, that taking the words of the widow at face value, you had every reason to think what you did. But since it was God's will to do something else, and they've gone by, go on and open the door, and go get us something to eat."
"Sir, wait until they've gone down the street," I said. Finally, my master came up to the door that led to the street and opened it, reassuring me. And I really needed that because I was so upset and afraid. So I started up the street again. But even though we ate well that day, I didn't enjoy it a damn bit. In fact, I didn't get my color back for 3 days. And my master would grin every time he thought about what I'd done. So that's what happened to me during those days with my third poor master, this squire. And all the time I was wishing I knew how he'd come to this place and why he was staying here. Because from the very first day I started serving him, I realized he was a stranger here. He hardly knew anyone, and he didn't associate with very many of the people around here. Finally, my wish came true, and I found out what I wanted to know. One day after we'd eaten fairly well and he was pretty content, he told me about himself. He said he was from Old Castile, and he said the only reason he'd left there was because he didn't want to take his hat off to a neighbor of his who was a high-class gentleman. "Sir," I said, "if he was the kind of man you say he was, and his status was higher than yours, it was only right for you to take your hat off first. After all, you say that he took off his hat too?"
"That is the kind of man he was. His status was higher, and he did take his hat off to me. But considering all the time I took mine off first, it wouldn't have been asking too much for him to be civil and make the first move once in a while."
"It seems to me, sir," I told him, "that I wouldn't even think about that, especially with people who are my superiors and are better off than I am."
"You're just a boy," he answered, "and you don't understand honor. That is the most important thing to any self-respecting gentleman these days. Well, I want you to know that I am a squire, as you can see, but I swear to God that if I meet a count on the street and he doesn't take his hat all the way off his head for me, the next time I see him coming, I'll duck right into a house and pretend that I have some business or other to do there. Or I'll go up another street, if there is one, before he gets up to me, just so I won't have to take off my hat to him.
because a gentleman doesn't owe anything to anyone except God or the king, and it isn't right, if he's a man of honor, for him to let his self-respect fall even for a minute. I remember one day when I put a craftsman from my town in his place, and I felt like strangling him too, because every time I ran into him he would say, "God keep you, friend." "You little peasant," I said to him, "how dare you address me with 'God keep you,' as if I were just anybody. Where were you brought up?" And from that day on, whenever he saw me, he took off his hat and spoke to me the way he was supposed to.
But isn't that a good way for one man to greet another, to say, "God keep you"?
"Damn it," he said, "that's what they say to the lower classes. But the people who are higher up, like me, they're only supposed to say, 'I hope you are well today, sir,' or at least, 'I hope you feel well today,' if the person talking to me is a gentleman. So I didn't want to put up with that man from my town who was filling me up to here with his 'God keep you.' I won't stand for anyone, including the king himself, to say to me, 'God keep you, friend.'"
"Well, I'll be," I said. "That's why God doesn't help you out. You won't let anyone ask him to."
"Especially," he said, "because I'm not so poor. In fact, where I'm from, I have a huge estate. It's 50 miles from where I was born, right along Costanilla, the main street of Valladolid. And if the houses on it were still standing and kept up, it would be worth more than 6,000 pieces of silver, just to give you an idea of how big and grand it would be. And I have a huge pigeon house that would produce more than 200 pigeons a year, if it hadn't fallen down. And there are some other things I won't mention, but I left them all because of my honor. And I came to the city thinking I'd find a good position, but it hasn't turned out the way I thought it would. I meet lots of canons and other officials of the church, but those people are so tight with their money that no one could possibly get them to change their ways. Lesser men want me too, but working for them is a lot of trouble. They want you to change from a man into a jack of all trades, and if you won't, they give you the sack. And generally, the paydays are few and far between. Most of the time, your only sure way of being paid is when they feed you, and when they want to have a clear conscience and really pay you for the sweat of your brow, your payoff comes from their clothes closet, with a sweaty old jacket or a ragged cape or coat. And even when a man has a position with someone of the nobility, he still has his troubles. I ask you, aren't I clever enough to serve one of them and make him happy? Lord, if I ran into one, I really think I'd be his favorite. And I could do lots of things for him. Why, I could lie to him just as well as anyone else could. And I could flatter him like he'd never seen before. And I'd laugh at his stories and jokes, even if they weren't exactly the funniest things in the world. I'd never tell him anything disturbing, even if he would be better off knowing it. I would be very conscientious in everything about him, both in word and in deed. And I wouldn't kill myself to do these things he wouldn't see. Whenever he was around to hear me, I would always scold the servants so he'd think I was very concerned about him. And if he were scolding one of his servants, I'd step in with some pointed remarks about the culprit that would make the nobleman even madder while I was appearing to take the servant's side. I would praise the things he'd like, but I'd mock and slander the people of the house and even the ones who didn't live there. I would go prying and try to find out about other people's lives so I could tell him about them. And I do all sorts of other things like this that go on in palaces these days, and that people in that sort of position like. They don't want to see good men in their homes. In fact, they think they're useless, and actually, they hate them. They say they're stupid people you can't deal with, and that a nobleman can't confide in them. And smart people these days act with the nobility, as they say, just the way I would. But with my bad luck, I haven't met one of them.
And so my master complained about his unhappy life, too, telling me how admirable he was. Well, about this time, a man and an old woman came in the door. The man wanted the rent money for the house, and the old lady had rented him the bed and wanted the money for that. They figured up the amount, and for 2 months' rent they wanted what he couldn't have made in a year. I think it was about 12 or 13 pieces of silver. And he answered them very courteously. He said that he would go out to the square to change a doubloon, and that they should come back that afternoon. But when he left, he never came back. So they returned in the afternoon, but it was too late. I told them that he still hadn't come back, and when night came and he didn't, I was afraid to stay in the house alone. So I went to the women next door and told them what had happened, and I slept at their place. The next morning, the creditors returned, but no one was home, so they came to the door of the place I was staying now and asked about their neighbor. And the women told them, "Here is his servant and the door key." Then they asked me about him, and I told them I didn't know where he was and that he hadn't come back home after going to get the change, and I said that I thought he'd given both them and me the slip. When they heard that, they went to get a constable and a notary, and then they came back with them and took the key and called me and some witnesses over, and they opened the door and went inside to take my master's property until he paid what he owed them. They walked through the entire house and found it empty, just as I've said. And they asked me, "What's become of your master's things, his chests and drapes and furniture?" "Well, I don't know anything about that," I answered. "It's obvious," they said, "that last night they must have had it all taken out and carted somewhere else. Constable, arrest this boy. He knows where it is." Then the constable came over and grabbed me by the collar of my jacket, and he said, "Boy, you're under arrest unless you tell us what's happened to your master's things."
You've been listening to Lazarillo de Tormes on Books Unbound, a production of Community Radio WFHB. We'll be back after the break. Return to Lazarillo de Tormes and Books Unbound on WFHB.
I'd never seen myself in such a fix. I had, of course, been held by the collar lots of times before, but that was done gently so that I could guide that man who couldn't see down the road. And so I was really scared. And while crying, I promised to answer their questions. "All right," they said, "then tell us what you know. Don't be afraid." The notary sat down on a stone bench so he could write out the inventory, and he asked me what things my master had. "Sir," I said, "according to what my master told me, he has a nice estate with houses on it and a pigeon house that isn't standing anymore." "All right," they said, "even though it probably isn't worth much, it will be enough to pay off his bill. And what part of the city is it located in?" they asked me. "In his town," I answered. "For God's sake, we're really getting far," they said, "and just where is this town?" "He told me that he came from Old Castile," I replied. And the constable and notary laughed out loud and said, "This sort of information would be good enough to pay off your debt, even if it was bigger." The neighbor ladies were there, and they said, "Gentlemen, this is just an innocent boy, and he's only been with that squire a few days. He doesn't know any more about him than you do. Besides, the poor little fellow has been coming to our house, and we've given him what we could to eat out of charity, and at night he's gone to his master's place to sleep." When they saw that I was innocent, they let me loose and said I was free to go. So, as I've said, my poor third master left me, and I saw the hand of my bad luck in this too. It showed how much it was going against me, because it arranged my affair so backward that instead of me leaving my master, which is what normally happens, my master left and ran away from me.
Chapter 4. How Lazaro went to work for a friar of the Order of Mercy, and what happened to him.
I had to get a fourth master, and this one turned out to be a friar of the Order of Mercy. The women I mentioned recommended him to me. They said he was a relative. He didn't think much of choir duties or eating in the monastery. He was always running around on the outside, and he was really devoted to secular business and visiting. In fact, he was so dedicated to this that I think he wore out more shoes than the whole monastery put together. He gave me the first pair of shoes I ever wore, but they didn't last me a week, and I wouldn't have lasted much longer myself trying to keep up with him. So because of this and some other little things that I don't want to mention, I left him.
Chapter 5. How Lazaro went to work for a partner and the things that happened to him then.
As luck would have it, the fifth one I ran into was a seller of papal indulgences. He was arrogant, without principles, the biggest hawker of indulgences that I've ever seen in my life, or ever hope to see, and probably the biggest one of all time. He had all sorts of ruses and underhanded tricks, and he was always thinking up new ones. When he'd come to a place where he was going to sell these pardons, first he'd give the priests and the other clergy some presents, just little things that really weren't worth much, some lettuce from Mercia, a couple limes or oranges if they were in season, maybe a peach, some pears, the kind that stay green even after they're ripe. That way he tried to win them over so they'd look kindly on his business and call out their congregation to buy up the indulgences. When they thanked him, he'd find out how well educated they were. If they said they understood Latin, he wouldn't speak a word of it so they couldn't trip him up. Instead, he'd use some refined, polished-sounding words and flowery phrases. And if he saw that these clerics were appointed reverends, I mean that they bought their way into the priesthood instead of by going through school, he turned into a St. Thomas, and for 2 hours he'd speak Latin, or at least something that sounded like Latin, even if it wasn't. When they wouldn't take his pardons willingly, he'd try to find some underhanded way to get them to take them. To do that, he'd sometimes make a nuisance of himself, and other times he'd use his bag of tricks. It would take so long to talk about all the things I saw him do. He didn't have to give a sermon or even go to church. People came right up to the inn to get them as if they were going out of style. So in the 10 or 12 places we went to around there, my master sold a good 1,000 indulgences in each place without even preaching a sermon. While the miracle was happening, I have to admit that I was astonished too, and I got taken in just like the others. But when I saw the way my master laughed and joked about the business later, I realized that it had all been cooked up by my sharp and clever master. And even though I was only a boy, it really amused me, and I said to myself, I'll bet these shysters do this all the time to innocent people. Well, to be brief, I stayed with my fifth master about 4 months, and I had some hard times with him too. Chapter 6, How Lazaro Went to Work for a Chaplain and What Happened to Him Then. After this, I took up with a man who painted tambourines. He wanted me to grind the colors for him, and I had my trials with him too. By now, I was pretty well grown up, and one day when I went into the cathedral, a chaplain there gave me a job. He put me in charge of a donkey, 4 jugs, and a whip, and I began to sell water around the city. This was the first step I took up the ladder to success. My dreams were finally coming true. On weekdays, I gave my master 60 coppers out of what I earned, while I was able to keep everything I got above that. And on Saturdays, I got to keep everything I made. I did so well at the job that after 4 years of it, watching my earnings very carefully, I saved enough to buy myself a good secondhand suit of clothes. I bought a jacket made out of old cotton, a frayed coat with braid on the sleeves and an open collar, a cape that had once been velvety, and an old sword, one of the first ones ever made in Cuellar. When I saw how good I looked in my gentleman's clothes, I told my master to take back his donkey. I wasn't about to do that kind of work anymore. Chapter 7, How Lazaro Went to Work for a Constable and What Happened to Him Then. After I left the chaplain, I was taken on as bailiff by a constable, but I didn't stay with him very long. The job was too dangerous for me. That's what I decided after some escaped criminals chased me and my master with clubs and rocks. My master stood there and faced them, and they beat him up, but they never did catch me, so I quit that job. And while I was trying to think of what sort of a life I could lead so that I could have a little peace and quiet and save up something for my old age, God lit up my path and put me on the road to success. With the help of some friends and other people, all the trials and troubles I'd gone through up till then were finally compensated for, seeing as how I got what I wanted, a government job. And no one ever gets ahead without a job like that.
And that's what I've been doing right up till now. I work in God's service, and yours too. What I do is announce the wines that are being sold around the city. Then, too, I call out at auctions and whenever anything lost. And I go along with the people who are suffering for righteousness' sake and call out their crimes. I'm a town crier, to put it plainly. It's been a good job, and I've done so well at it that almost all of this sort of work comes to me. In fact, it's gotten to the point where if someone in the city has wine or anything else to put up for sale, they know it won't come to anything unless Lazarillo of Tormes is in on it. About this time, that gentleman, the Archpriest of San Salvador, your friend and servant, began to notice my abilities and how I was making a good living. He knew who I was because I'd been announcing his wines, and he said he wanted me to marry a maid of his. And I saw that only good, profitable things come from a man like him, so I agreed to go along with it. So I married her, and I've never regretted it, because besides the fact that she's a good woman and she's hardworking and helpful, through my lord, the archpriest, I have all the help and favors I need. During the year, he always gives her a few good-sized sacks of wheat, meat on the holidays, a couple loaves of bread sometimes, and his socks after he's through with them. He had us rent a little house right next to his, and on Sundays and almost every holiday, we eat at his place. But there have always been scandalmongers, and I guess there always will be, and they won't leave us in peace. They talk about I don't know what all. They say that they've seen my wife go and make up his bed and do his cooking for him. And God bless them, but they're a bunch of liars. Because besides the fact that she's the kind of woman who's hardly happy about these jibes, my master made me a promise, and I think he'll keep it. One day, he talked to me for a long time in front of her, and he said to me, Lazaro of Tormes, anyone who pays attention to what gossips say will never get ahead. I'm telling you this because I wouldn't be at all surprised if someone did see your wife going in and out of my house. In fact, the reason she goes in is very much to your honor and to hers, and that's the truth. So forget what people say. Just think of how it concerns you. I mean, how it benefits you. Sir, I said, I've decided to be on the side of good men. It is true that some of my friends have told me something of that. The truth is, they've sworn for a fact that my wife had 3 children before she married me, speaking with reverence to your grace since she's here with us. Then my wife began to scream and carry on so much that I thought the house with us in it was going to fall in. Then she took to crying, and she cursed the man who had married us. It got so bad that I'd rather I died than have let those words of mine slip out. But with me on one side and my master on the other, we talked to her and begged her so much that she finally quit her crying. And I swore to her that as long as I lived, I'd never mention another word about the business. And I told her I thought it was perfectly all right, in fact that it made me happy, for her to go in and out of his house both day and night because I was so sure of her virtue. And so we were all 3 in complete agreement. So, right up to today, we've never said another word about the affair. In fact, when I see that someone wants to even start talking about it, I cut him short and I tell him, look, if you're my friend, don't tell me something that will make me mad because anyone who does that isn't my friend at all, especially if they're trying to cause trouble between me and my wife. There's nothing and nobody in the world that I love more than her. And because of her, God gives me all sorts of favors, many more than I deserve. So I'll swear to God that she's as good a woman as any here in Toledo, and if anyone tells me otherwise, I'm his enemy until I die. So no one ever says anything to me, and I keep peace in my house. That was the same year that our victorious emperor came to this illustrious city of Toledo and held his court here, and there were all sorts of celebrations and festivities, as you must have heard. Well, at this time, I was prosperous and at the height of all good fortune. Thank you.
Lazaro's story ends so abruptly and improbably that his fans clamored for more. A sequel appeared a year later, and others were to follow. After hints throughout that some of his masters might have exploited him sexually, his happy ending hinges on making a heteronormative marriage. And yet, as his mother had, Lazaro's wife resorts to trading sexual favors to obtain basic needs and comforts. A few critics have questioned whether the story really takes the side of the underdog. The underprivileged, usually thought to be its audience, probably couldn't read. Despite its unsophisticated surface, the Lazarillo story might have been intended to confront more comfortable readers with their own moral ambiguities and ironies.
Listening to the conclusion of The Life of Lazarillo de Tormes, His Fortunes and Misfortunes as Told by Himself, from the translation of Robert S. Rutter. Tony Brewer was our reader. Tony is a poet, spoken word performer, and sound effects artist. He's executive producer of the Spoken Word Stage at the 4th Street Festival and chair of the Writers Guild at Bloomington. Books Unbound is a production of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana. The Life of Lazarillo de Tormes, His Fortunes and Misfortunes, produced and written by Cynthia Wolfe, with assistant producers Robert Scholl and Doug Storm. Music for Lazarillo de Tormes comes from La Folia by Diego Ortiz and was performed by Jordi Savalli. Theme music by The Impossible Shapes. You can listen to this and every episode of Books Unbound at wfhb.org/news/bub. If you have comments or suggestions for Books Unbound, or to receive information about auditions and events, email booksunbound@wfhb.org. And join us next Saturday at 5. This is Berkeley Going for Books Unbound, classic and contemporary literature that challenges the limits of free expression. Thanks for listening.